Good morning. That's better. You ignored him, so thank you. I feel privileged, actually, you know. I've been in church my entire life. I actually grew up a block away from the church we went to. And I want to make a confession this morning that has to do with what I'm going to talk about. I want to spend time this morning talking and getting you to think along with me about Genesis chapter 1 and 2, because all the time I spent in church for my entire lifetime, I don't think I've ever literally heard a sermon just on Genesis 1 and 2. I've heard lots of sermons that relate to that or pick out a piece of it or some other kind of thing, but almost all the sermons I've heard have been Genesis 3 on. What happened in Genesis 3 was Adam and Eve sent us on a trajectory that's been miserable ever since. Scott Peck says it this way. He says, life is difficult. That's how he starts one of his books, and it's marked. It was a marked message for a generation, for sure. And I think it's gotten worse, not better, frankly. So I think I did this with you before, but I want to start off this way this morning. If you're going to leave here with some sense of what garden living means, then you need to learn to walk like Jesus walked in this world. Dallas Willard says that the one single word he would use to describe Jesus is relaxed. I know if you're a rebel like me, you're not going to do what I say, but I ask you to do, but I'm going to beseech you to go along with this for just a minute, would you, you know? Close your eyes. I don't know where your hands are, but can you relax them? Breathe in through your nose, slowly, hold it, out through your mouth, no sound. I love the silence. That peace, that little space, that tiny place, that momentary breath is literally the breath of life that God gives us. And it's designed to be an anchor point for the way that we live life in this world. We just sang a marvelous song about he's still on the throne. And because he's still on the throne, we can trust him. And he's done all this stuff. It's finished and his work is done. And it's fascinating to me that the garden story says that God finished his work and then he did something. He gave a Sabbath. One author says that Sabbath may be the single greatest gift that God produced in creation. It was good, it was good, it was good, it was good, it was good. And then what? Now it's time to rest. And most of us don't get there very often, and we certainly don't live there. So I want to start off this morning and kind of recap the four sermons before this one that relate to the garden story, that forum that Aaron preached to us, and the first one was about God himself. Well, I would argue that one of the things that we get wrong about God that I've noticed through my life is I keep getting messages that are mixed messages about God, and here's the message. One of the things that we need to hang on to is that God is absolutely good. That's what it says in 1 John. He says it this way. He says, God's light, and in him is no darkness, and then he adds this, at all. But most of us carry a image of God that has some darkness to it because there's a mystery there and we're not sure, and so there's so much evil that we live with, so much angst, so much bitterness, so much hurt, so much fear, so much anger, so much resentment, so much whatever. Depression and loneliness and you name it. All that stuff happened in chapter 3. This morning, I want to immerse us in chapter 1 and 2. And the God that created, he created to be in relationship with us. He wanted us to experience, I think, the primary relational dynamic of living that's so much fun when you sit around a table and just enjoy one another. Because he enjoyed the Trinity. He enjoyed his son and the spirit, and the three of them had an ongoing relationship, and it's the ground out of which we do any relational work at all. So Sabbath, this freaky piece, one of the pieces, one of the weeks, that's what Aaron taught about. He taught about Sabbath, and I wrote down here, Sabbath means a deep rest. Not just let's get a few hours in and hope we can make it the next day. A deep rest and a deep peace. Do you operate out of peace mostly? You're anxious. Are you triggered by anxiety in some way? It's a near synonym for the word, the biblical word shalom. And shalom actually means a state of wholeness, of flourishing in every dimension of life. And so when you wish somebody shalom, when you say that to them, you're saying, I want you to flourish and I want you to experience wholeness. Wholeness literally means every aspect and dimension of your life. What we're going to find out, though, is that after chapter 3, we don't have access to that because we've covered up most of the time. Jesus says, the Sabbath was made for you. And he says, I'm Lord of the Sabbath. Really what he's saying is, I am the Sabbath. You need to be in relationship with me. Does that make sense? I mean, that's powerful imagery and powerful language given to us in the garden originally, and then chapter 3 distorted it. So I want you to come with me on a little walk back into the garden this morning. A couple other things that we were taught. One was about a whole week we spent on identity. And the fact of the matter is, you are an image bearer of God. And there's not a person in the 8 billion people on this planet that are not image bearers. When you're angry and fearful and mad and resentful and vengeful and want justice and say it's not fair and you've been treated poorly and you don't like somebody, all those people carry the very same image of God that you do. And if you want to obliterate the fear that roots prejudice and roots out our distinctiveness of separation from people, that's the core piece. And so getting your identity straight is no small thing. And I'm going to suggest to you before we get done this morning that the sole source of identity is God's grace. Paul sees it. I'll show you where. We need to work. We get to work. Work is fun. Work should be joyful. I was with 20 pastors for a week this last week. Great time. They were from literally all over the world. One came from Cambodia, from Switzerland, Germany. They were in one group, and a random statement was made during that time that bears on what I'm talking about this morning, and it so kind of shocked me a little bit. I went, whoa, where did that come from? And this fellow pastor was saying, I think in the redeemed kingdom, we're going to need war to motivate us. I thought, what? Where did that come from, for pity's sakes? I think we've got to be careful with what motivates us. We have to understand that motivation from a biblical standpoint and from a godly standpoint is that God's love and mercy and grace fundamentally provide the sole source of motivation for us to live in this world. We don't get there very often. So I have a cartoon for you this morning. The first service was so dead, they didn't get it, so I'm going to read it to you. Is that too much for you? Okay, here we go. Sometimes, Charlie says, I just want someone to hug me and say, I understand your pain. It's going to be okay. Here's a coffee and $2 million. The $2 million, from a biblical standpoint, God's gift of grace to us. Life is hard. I don't want to minimize that. After the fall, it's hard. But what we're offered is we're offered, as Paul found out, grace that's enough. Grace that's sufficient. Grace that you don't need more. You don't ever need to go to God and say, I need more grace or I need more faith. You don't need more. God provides you everything you need for life and godliness. So there's a guy named Robert Capon, and he writes this. He says, the first thing I noted, talking about Genesis 1 and 2, was that the whole biblical account of creation, there is not a single evil thing. Everything that comes from the hand of God, including Adam and Eve, and most important, everything that's available for Adam and Eve to know, is solid 24-karat good. God's good, and in him is no darkness at all. And most of us carry this duplicitous view of God around for a lifetime and don't access what we just sang about in that song. No self-consciousness happened until chapter 3. You see, we were made naked and unashamed. When I talk to couples, I get to do couples retreats. And one of the questions I usually ask is, okay, so what's the purpose of marriage? Now, if you're single, hang in there, because it's probably the purpose for your life as well, married or not. But I will ask them, what's the purpose of marriage? And I get all kinds of answers. Most of them are pretty good. But I think the primary purpose is to expose you. Now, exposure is something that's counterintuitive for most of us. We cover up. We hide. We defend ourselves. Here's something. I don't think in the garden we were designed to have to be defensive. And no animal is self-conscious. So you get back to the garden, we carry self-consciousness. What's that mean? We chose knowing, which is power, and the good, and we linked it with evil's distortion. So it was the knowledge of the tree of good and evil that propelled them out of the garden. And it was not built into the creation. It's rather a link that was released as a result of wanting to know rather than to relate. We're made to be in relationship. The biblical message is relationship from the beginning all the way to the end. And most people, when they value their life at the end, they will talk about their relationships, not their production. It's because relationships is what we're made for. Relationships is what satisfies our soul. Relationships is what we're given. And if somebody can be graced to us, we're going to link to them in some way. We have coaches. We have friends. We have family. It comes in all different forms. It surprises us a lot of times, but it's there. So the idea is that to know we wanted power when we left the garden. So we're out of chapter 1 and 2 now, and here's the distortion. Now, the self becomes an object outside of ourselves, and we have ourselves on our hands. The joy of self-forgetfulness is an attempt to return to the way we were made. When you have yourself on your hands, you cannot use these hands for somebody else. Self-forgetfulness means that I finally am not worried about me. I'm not worried about how you think about me. I'm not worried about how I look. I'm not worried about any of that. I am simply present in my own skin. And most people can't do that because we're fallen. That's what happened to us. And so self-consciousness shows up after the fall. With it, defensiveness. And with it comes two other things that I don't think happened in the garden either. So I'm interested in chapters 1 and 2 now, because I believe that what the salvation message is, what we need to be rescued from and returned to, is the garden. It's what good news means. It means to live in that space. But we don't do that most of the time. We are fighting something out here and not receiving the adequate message about the grace of God. So that's this morning in a sense. So I think there's a couple other things that happened in the garden that weren't in the garden that happened in chapter 3. One is we became fearful. No reason to fear in the garden. The fear comes afterwards. Fear is an anti-relational emotion, and here's why. Every time you're afraid of somebody, you push them away. You want distance between yourself and them. If you've ever, I'm not going to tell you what I'm watching, but there are some series I watch. I made a mistake of telling people one time, and it's not good, you know? Because you may watch it and go, really? Or you may watch it and say, what? Anyway, I was watching this, and they had a person that personified evil in them, and every time it would show up in the series, I would want to leave the room. He was so evil. I mean, you just made your skin crawl. So you wanted to leave and say, how'd it turn out? You know, because you know there's more episode, so that's a good sign. You know, that's what happens in movies, right? Anyway, fear. Fear is not something we should have to deal with, and fear is antithetical to relationship. Just like anger. Anger and fear are the opposite sides of the same coin, because anger, you push somebody away. Fear, you run away. Either way, you're adding distance to the relationship, and God's made us to be relational. It's not good for us to be alone. It's good for us to be in community. It's good for us to have somebody else see us and see, give us input and be able to love us, and we are made for that. And so many people never get the message that they're beloved. So their identity is malformed, and on you go. All of this is promulgated by the word shame. Naked and what? Unashamed. After they left the garden, they were shame-based. I think we're not designed to live, and why we don't taste and see that God's good, and why we don't draw strength out of life that we sing about a lot of times, is that we have not actually put into practice, applied the grace of God to our lives. So consequently, we react to shame instead of doing what Jesus did with it, despised it and scorned it and pushed it away. Shame will not tell you the truth about God or yourself. Naked and what? Unashamed. The cross of Christ and the grace of God gives us access to a life without shame. Not only guilt, but we are the ones that have to push back against the shame. God says it is finished in the garden. Jesus said after, on the cross, he says it is finished. Those two, it is finishes, are bookends for the Christian life. The cross gives us all that we need to access a life where we can take a deep breath and we can have deep peace and be there. C.S. Lewis says this: we are half-hearted creatures fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy or peace and grace is offered to us like an ignorant child who goes on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea. We are far too easily pleased. Don't stop your development because you can't imagine being back in the garden. The garden that God made us, God made it perfectly. He didn't make any mistakes in there, and he wasn't fooling with us, and he wasn't pretentious, and he wasn't keeping score, and he wasn't capricious, and he wasn't, you know, all the things that help us not trust somebody. Trust is this central piece in all relational activity, and we just struggle with it. Nothing but grace. It's simply Jesus. A love affair with an unlosable lover. The grace of the gospel tells you that all the incomprehensible good news really is so. I just want to stop here just for a second. The grace of the gospel is for people who are already following Jesus. The gospel of grace is for people who haven't chosen yet to follow. There's a difference. The problem is the grace of the gospel is for us. And most people who are following God don't ever really get his grace, so they don't really gain the freedom that you can have and the peace that's offered to us in the midst of whatever turmoil or conflict or context we're in. You can open your hands, you can relax, you can do counterintuitive things to push back against the fallenness of this world. You are loved, you are vindicated, you are home. Most of us don't feel that quite often. We don't feel loved, we think we have to earn it, or we didn't get loved by the people we thought we should. Or, you know, I don't know how many men I know that have never been blessed by their fathers. And they've never been able to cross that divide, and so they always feel a little less, it's like they're still striving to be blessed by somebody that maybe can't bless them or aren't around to bless them or some other kind of thing. Who knows what happens? It doesn't really matter. The point is God blesses you. God loves you. God wants you. God moves towards you. God initiates. God invites. He's not playing a game, but we think he is quite often because we project onto him our own experiences, like our experiences are going to tell us the truth. They can't. They're too limited. They're too finite. You are loved. You are vindicated. You're home, and you're all of that right now. Ephesians 2:8 says this, "For by grace, you're saved." What are we saved from? We're saved from the false view of reality that occurs after we leave the garden. They chose a false view of reality, Adam and Eve did, when they chose to believe the lie that Satan produced. You're saved through faith, and that, even faith, is not of yourselves. That is also a gift. So grace is a gift, and also this. Now, my wife said this morning, or not this morning, but the other day, she says, "You need to define grace." I can't. But I didn't tell her that, and so here we go. I'm going to give you a list of things that fit under this title. It's a very elastic word, so hang on. Here we go. There's the grace of a dancer, which I'm not, so I'm not going to dance. Relax. You know, you're okay. There's the grace before a meal. Remember the movie? Would you say grace? Grace. Do you remember that movie? If you don't know the movie, good. That's fine. There's grace for different denominations, and there's grace that really is a good definition of what grace is: one-way love. If you've received one-way love, guess what? You can give it. Part of the thing that you did, Aaron, with identity when you were talking about it was, you don't complete me. God's completed me. I'm not in the relationship to get something. I'm in this relationship to learn how to give, because I'm designed primarily to give. Why? Why? Because that's what God does. He gives us life. He created us, and then he gave us all that we needed for life and godliness. He's not withholding things from us. He equipped you like you needed to be equipped. You don't have to live out of scarcity, ever. He says, "I have come that you might have life in abundance." But we're in a battle. Because the line before that is Satan's work, or the enemy's work, or the adversary's work, is to steal, kill, and destroy. Andrew Root says this: "Grace is a miracle, particularly in a world soaked in so many forms of resentment. Ours is an age at war, one that's fueled by blame, punishment, and revenge." We love it all, by the way. We love blame, punishment, and revenge. We find it delicious to see our enemies suffer. I don't know how many movies I've watched in the last 10 or 15 years. Almost all of them have a revenge theme, some kind of vindication and some kind of justice. That's the driving urge. A lot of times it just leaves God out of it, like we can bring about justice because I know that that's wrong. And the whole justice thing is confusing to us a lot of times because we drop the character of God in each person. Anyway, he goes on, he says, "We love it. We find it delicious to see our enemies suffer. This mindset has made for a generation who are terrified to live. In such an environment, we need a miracle. We need to be reminded of the miracle of grace itself." All right, so grace is the nature of a God who comes to us in mercy and gives us freedom. This is love and mercy together, and it's known as grace. I have some questions, and I want you to know that I have some questions, and they're not going to be up here, but I want to tell you about them, because at my age, following Jesus hard my whole life, I still wonder about a bunch of stuff, and here's what I wonder about. First one: I don't know why God insisted on granting us freedom to run our own history in the first place. Because it seems we screwed it up pretty bad, right? The second question I have is, I don't know why he insists on leaving us free enough to botch it in the second place. What's that about? I still ponder. And the third one is, I don't know why he insists on saving it in the third place. I wouldn't have. I'd have just started over again. That's the outrage of grace. God simply does not keep score. This is important because we do. Most of our resentment, bitterness, injustice collection, saying it's not okay, comes from keeping score. History does. History keeps score. We keep score. But keeping score, listen to this, ends the game. A game ends when somebody wins, right? You take the ball and go home, it's over. We finished it, you know, they won or they didn't win, that kind of thing. God doesn't keep score. Why? Because he's not in it that way. He wants to keep playing. And keep playing the game means that you got to keep the ball in play. God never takes the ball and goes home. Says, you didn't play right. You didn't play fair. You're stupid. He doesn't say that. He what? Keeps the ball in play. Keeps hitting it back to you. Your job, my job, is to keep the ball in play. And that's grace, actually. If you keep score, you end the game. And therefore, you end the relationship. And he refuses to do it. So this unfair outrage was voiced perfectly by the elder brother in Luke 15. If you know the story about the elder brother and the younger brother, the elder brother has done everything right. He's kept the commandments. He's done right. He's done good. He should get rewarded for it. And what's he doing? He's complaining and he's saying this. He's saying, life is not fair. Now, I bet somewhere in your life, you have those words have come out of your mouth, even if you're just little. Most parents know that phrase because we've said it to our own children. Well, life's not fair. You don't get what Johnny gets. It's not fair. Do you identify with that at all? Life is not fair, and the father's only answer to that voice, his voice perfectly when he answers his son, he says, we had to be merry. We had to live. We had to rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live and was lost and has been rescued. That's what grace does. Grace gets you to the party. The interesting story about the prodigal son and the elder brothers, I'm not sure either of them got to the party. I think the younger brother was sitting there, but I'm not sure he had much fun. Life should be lived. Life should be tasted deeply. Life should be savored. Life should be delighted in because it's a gift. 1 Corinthians 15:10 summarizes this in a fairly unique way. So just listen to this, the backstory. This is Paul talking to the Corinthian church in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And he says something like this. He says, if the resurrection did not happen, if Christ was not raised from the dead, then let's just get out. Let's go do something else because this is the only way that anything makes sense. If he was raised from the dead, then let's pay attention. And so then he goes through a list and he says, after Jesus came out of the grave, there some women saw him and then he showed himself to his disciples and then to 500 people and then to the apostles. And then eventually Paul gets around to talking about himself. Now, what do we know about Paul? We know that Paul was avidly against the church. He was actively killing Christians. Now, his whole life shifted around and he began to finally be grounded in the garden again. And there's a verse that says, verse 10 says this. It says, first, he says, it's by the grace of God I am what I am. That's his identity. Now, where does that identity come from? He says, it comes from simply God's grace. Not my parents, not my church, not my involvement in something else, not my discipline, not anything else. It's simply a gift. Pure. Unadulterated gift. I had a client one time, I gave him a little box and I said, wrap this box up, put a bow on it, carry it around all week. And they looked at me like, what? This is therapy in depth, you know, kind of thing. So they carried it around. I said, when you go to the bathroom, you set it on top of the toilet, right? Don't flush it, just keep it there. You know, at work, it should be on your desk, on and on. And at the end of the week, I want you to report back to me. And I said, so you have to tell people when they ask you, what is that? And you have to say, well, it's a gift. And then what will you say? They'll say, well, what is it? And they'll say, I don't know. Well, why don't you know? Well, I've never opened it. I think this is what happens to grace. And Paul is telling you, he opened grace, and guess what he found? He says, it's by God's grace. My identity is rooted in who he is. And he uses a phrase that's so powerful that it's almost heretical. He says, I am what I am. That's Moses asking God to tell him his name. What's your name, God? God says, I am. Paul has the boldness, because of grace, to be able to declare his identity is rooted in the very same grace that God's given. I am who I am. And then the second thing Paul says, which is powerful, and we need to hear it. He says, and his grace, there's that grace word again, and his grace toward me did not prove vain, but I labored more than all of them. His grace provided the motivation for me to live life fully. The only motive that a Christian needs is grace. Not performance, not ritual, not never lying, not any questions, not lack of any, however you want to define it. The only thing we need to move us is a realization that his grace is enough, and it's the reason for us to live. And it was the impetus and the energy source in the garden's description. It just didn't come out as the word grace, because the garden was immersed in it. It's like fish and water. Christians live in grace. And Paul says, it was God's grace that motivated me. And the third thing he says in this single verse, he says, and his grace, yet not I, but the grace of God with me. So he's saying, I'm motivated to do life based on who I am, and I'm empowered by the same source, the grace of God with me. Grace gives me an identity. Grace gives me a motivation. Grace gives me the power to do life. End of sentence. It's not more Bible study. It's not more prayer. It's not more. None of those are bad. They need to come out of grace, not to be sources for us to access grace. We need to start with grace. We need to get back to the garden and stand in the gift that God's giving us on the cross. It is finished, he says, in the garden. His work was done. And then Christ says the very same thing on the cross. He says, it's finished. So now you have access back to that. I have a practice for you this week. And I would say all of you have a phone, and I dare you to put an alarm on your phone that would alert you 5 times a day in an arbitrary way, maybe every 2 hours or some such thing. And when it goes off, you just shut it off, and then you say these words, God loves me, and that's enough. I don't need anything else. I don't need another promotion. I don't need anything else. His love for me is what? It's enough. Will you take another breath with me? Will you close your eyes? In through your nose. Just hold it a second. Exhale. Father, none of us in this room could last without the next breath. That is a representation of your gift of grace to us. Each breath a gift. Each moment a gift. Some of us live a really hard life. Some of us are super lonely. Some of us are afraid. Some of us are anxious. Some of us are depressed. Your grace is sufficient. Your grace is enough. Your grace is the anchor to get us back to the garden, the very place and the way you designed us in the first place. And the cross actually accesses the tree of life again, because that's what it represents. Help us to be people who live out of that abundance. It says in Hebrews that we can approach the throne of grace boldly, with confidence. Why? Because your grace is enough. Thank you for providing that for us. We're saved by grace. We're made by grace. We're motivated by grace. We're energized by grace. We're strengthened by grace. I pray that we'll represent that well and steward it for your greater glory and our joy. I pray this in the strong and gentle name of your Son, Jesus.